welcome to the Sunshine Sound Podcast with your host, Christine Mathias.
It's not really in tune, though the scale we're used to now, this equal-tempered scale, is not exactly in tune. It's just enough out of tune, so it's sort of a compromise between, you know, being able to play relatively in tune and also being able to transpose versus being able to play extremely well in tune, but not being able to transpose. Some instruments, and this is what I was referring to earlier, like singers, brass ensembles, sometimes you will hear them, a choir will hit this harmony, barbershop quartets also will do this, they'll hit this harmony that just sounds so pure, it you know, just sets your hair on end.
Hello and welcome to episode number 13 of the Sunshine Sound Podcast. In this one, I interview John Noble, also known as Pretty Howtown. Maybe you've heard of him. He has come up a few times on the podcast. Anyone who's ever been to Open Oscillator certainly knows who he is. And he's also involved in a lot of other really cool festivals and like off-the-grid projects and performances in San Diego. There's no one quite like him, no one quite doing what he's doing. So he creates improvised electronic music on this analog modular synthesizer. So you'll have to go onto our social media pages and take a look at this thing to really get what we are talking about. So in the interview, this one is packed with information. John is really intelligent and he knows the intricacies of his music and the equipment that he uses. So he explains a lot of that really well throughout the interview. But we also get into a lot of interesting stuff like microtuning, his process for creating his music and kind of the math behind it. But also like the electronic music scene and his experiences with that. And of course, we'll get a chance to listen to a couple of these tracks. So try to keep up and I hope you enjoy. All right. So in the studio today, I have John Noble, also known as Pretty Howtown. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Oh, sure. So I wanted to have you on just because I've seen you perform and it's so cool what you do. Not only that, but you've actually come up in a lot of the podcasts. Like for some, you just come up in conversation with so many musicians. You really do. You're kind of, no one is quite doing what you're doing. Like, you probably can explain your instrument better than I can. So what is this contraption that we're looking at?
Well, this contraption is a modular synthesizer, and it's a particular format, which is called Eurorack, which is smaller than the old Moog, like telephone central office looking things that came from the 60s, which are still around, but they're kind of heavy and kind of big. And I wanted to be able to play out, so I chose this format.
So how did you get started? Were you using the different kinds of synthesizers and stuff in the past?
It goes back a long way.
Yeah.
I discovered modular synthesizers longer ago than I care to admit. it was the early 80s. And when I was in high school, somebody gave me a tape with the music of Isao Tomita on it, which is a Japanese composer that was one of the early users of Moog modular synthesizers. And he had done some classical music transcriptions. And I thought it was the most amazing thing I'd ever heard. And his record jackets famously list all of his gear that he used. So, you know, 1971, 72, which was, you know, so it had been out for about 10 years, but I just discovered it. I went and looked up the prices of this stuff, and I wasn't going to afford it on my paper route money. So I went and bought some books on electronics and making music circuits and made some things, and then ended up going to college for electronic engineering as a result. So really,
oh, really? That's
yeah, it goes back. It had a big effect on my life. But you know, many years go by. I was in car audio and was a loudspeaker designer and did some electronics, some coding, and and other things. And noticed in about 2008 or 9 that there were people making modular synthesizers again. It had never really quite stopped, but it had gone in the 80s and 90s more or less gone away, and then it had come back up. And I paid attention for about another year or two. I was like, I think it's going somewhere. And so about 7 years ago, I bought a bunch of modules after DIYing some stuff, and haven't slowed down since, really. But yeah, it's a long story. It's probably 1981 or two. Yeah,
It looks so complicated. Like, I kind of like, do you need to have that kind of background to figure out how to use this machine you have?
I don't think so. I think it helps some people to have a technical background. I think it might be an obstacle to some other people, because they get so wrapped up in the technology that they forget to make music. And so Wendy Carlos was a composer and not a super technical person, and, you know, did the groundbreaking albums with the original Moog synthesizers. The same thing for most of the really successful people were not from engineering backgrounds. It was more composition. So I think it might be kind of an obstacle. Sometimes I obsess over the engineering behind it and forget to make music.
Sure. But that, I mean, that's also the fun of it, right? You can kind of get at it from two different sides. Yeah.
Well, for me, the rabbit hole goes very deep, because I'm into woodworking and machining and electronics and music. And so, you know, the saying was, a Jedi makes his own lightsaber. And I wind up, if I can't buy it, then I have to go make it. And that's fun, and I enjoy it. And so there's pieces on this instrument that they're the only ones that exist. And maybe I made it last week. And maybe I'll throw it away and make something else the week after, because it's fun. You know?
Yeah, so you were telling me that, like, I don't really understand the different pieces of this instrument. So there was, like, you're talking about, like, the core of it is something that they're, that, who did you get that from?
Well, they come from a variety of sources. Probably should back up. The reason they call it a modular synthesizer is because there are modules that perform specific functions, and you can mix and match them. So typically, in a given format, there's a mechanical standard, so the way you mount things, and then an electrical standard, which is how they get power from a common source, and then how they interconnect. So in this case, there's a common power connector on the back that they all use. And then on the front, they all use basically that's the same size as a headphone jack that would plug into your phone. It's a 3.5 millimeter jack. And so you interconnect them that way. But each module has a specific purpose, usually. They can get very complex, but usually you'll have something that's an oscillator, or it's a filter, or it's an amplifier, or it's a mixer. And the complexity comes from taking these small, simple pieces and connecting them in ways that would be difficult to plan for. So typically you go buy a synthesizer, has a keyboard, they've already mapped out, this is how it's going to make sound. It's going to have three oscillators, and then a mixer, and then it's going to run through a filter that's controlled by an envelope, and then it comes out the left and right jacks, and you're done. This one, I can connect anything to anything with, you know, sometimes stunning results, and sometimes it's, you know, really terrible also. It depends on what you're after. But anything can modulate anything. So that's the big strength and the big weakness, because you can never return to where you were. Not exactly.
Right. Yeah. Do you, can you create the same piece over and over again? Or
no.
No.
No. And that was a hard thing to learn, because I would get somewhere with it early on and then never, yeah, I was still working. It wasn't quite something I liked, but I knew, you know, I didn't want to abandon it just yet. And so 2 weeks it would be making the same sounds. And I figured out you can't force it with one of these things. Either it's going to do what you hopefully are guiding it to do, or it's not. And if it's not, pull all the cables out, start over, and it's gone. And sometimes the decision to record or not record is along with that. It's doing something great. Do I go get the recorder, plug it in? Because I only record to 2-track stereo. Everything I do is to a portable recorder. Do I record it and break the flow and possibly, probably never recapture this? Or do I just enjoy it? And a lot of times I just enjoy it, because my record is not being good. When I get the recorder, then the magic, it evaporates.
Right. So do you go in with any kind of plan then? Or is it all just completely improvised every time?
increasingly, I've been hoping to go towards a little bit more compositional approach, but yeah, it's all improvised. I will have a sense of the mood of what I want to do, especially if I'm performing live. I'll look at who else is performing, where it is, where I am in the lineup, and then make decisions about, you know, is this going to be really, you know, something hard driving? Is it going to be, you know, communicating with whales or, you know, maybe all of the above?
Yeah. So when you have, so you have this like tiny little keyboard. So what can you control with that? Like, what are you programming into it?
Well, these days, so when I have a full size, like regular, this isn't a piano keyboard
type thing.
Yeah, this is a typing keyboard. I have a module that is essentially a computer. And there are some people out there on the internet who would say I have completely sold out after complaining about computers and music for years and in various forums. But I would say that this is more crafting your own instrument with code. So you write programs, basically, and it's like programming an old HP calculator or something. It has a lot in common with it. You can make this module do anything from, I'm trying to not get technical here, so low frequency oscillators to audio rate stuff to various control elements. You can make a sequencer out of it. And it's a choose your own adventure. And being that, you know, that's what I do professionally is I write software, then there's kind of a love-hate relationship with it. This feels very comfortable, but at the same time, I don't really want to do for my hobby and my passion what I do to make money, you know. But it the result is that I can have this now very small instrument that is extremely flexible and that has more more scope for taking a compositional approach. I can have longer sequences in. I can, well, we'll see. So in 2 days, I'm actually going to be, when is this coming out?
It won't come out till next week.
Okay, so. Perfect. Yeah, so I'm sort of doing a John Williams tribute on Wednesday at Open Oscillator.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And the reason why is because the solo movie is coming out. Opening day is officially Friday. But I will be at a video shoot with a friend of mine who's shooting a video for his album on Friday. So I'm going Thursday. But 41 years to the day, Friday was the release of Star Wars opening night. And that's what I was there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's my 10th opening night.
Wow.
So I'm doing my first cover set. I've never done cover. Well, I sort of did on May the 4th. There was a jazz thing that I opened for, and I used some of what I'm going to use at Open Oscillator. But so I can do that, which I could not have done before.
I can't even imagine you doing a cover. I mean, it's going to be your very unique version of a cover.
Yeah. You'll recognize stuff in there if you're there. But I don't, it's not, definitely not a straight ahead cover, but a tribute to. But I couldn't really have done that before. With analog sequencing approaches, or you'd have to have, you know, a sequencer the size of this room or something to be able to do it.
So where does like the melody come in if you're trying to get across a certain melody? Because I don't understand how you would have like notes.
Well, it depends. So to rewind to how it was done in the old days, you had a series of knobs and you twist them until you get the voltage you want that controls the oscillator that results in the pitch you want. And then there's other expressive elements. So how loud it is, the duration, the timing, and everything else can be done with traditional techniques pretty accurately if you have a lot of practice. And that's how I've done most of my performances and actually most of the recordings too, is just turning knobs.
Wow, it's so strange to me to think of affecting the pitch with a knob. Yeah.
Yeah. After a while, you get used to it. I play piano, and I've played piano for a long time. And I play guitar and it's been a while, but I still play sax a little bit and played a lot of brass instruments. And this feels as much like an instrument as any of the rest of them, with the exception of you feel more like you're a step up. You're more the conductor rather than the player. It's somewhere between conducting and playing. And
so who's playing?
Well, it's, you know, sort of a you know, this robot band you have going. And to me, I think of it as somewhere as of a blend of jazz and Baroque methods. And in Baroque times, they would actually lay out charts, much like they do in jazz now, for what amounted to the rhythm section, so your harpsichord player, the continuo. And they would say, okay, we all understand, you know, these musical approaches, so you guys go do something in A minor for a while, and we're going to be off, you know, soloing and doing our thing, much like a rhythm section in a rock band or a jazz band would do now. And so that's what I do, is you can only concentrate on so much when you're playing one of these things. And so I'll set the conditions right so the modular will go off and do its own thing.
It's like it's
and
vamping.
Keep it interesting. Yeah, exactly. And you do that with, you know, not programming it in. So you don't say, okay, these are the notes you're going to play. Use generative techniques. So sample and hold, feeding random numbers into the sequencer, maybe not totally random, but throwing a little bit of chance in there. And then it takes on a very human feel so that I can go concentrate on something else. And I'm particularly weak on doing like drums and drum-like things. I don't think like a drummer. And so I'll just turn it loose, maybe build up a drum beat out of dividing clocks. So divide by 13, divide by 7, divide by 2, add all those up, and then feed it to a hi-hat or something. And you get repeating patterns out of it that don't repeat too often, and they have kind of a human feel to it.
Wow, that's so cool. That's such a different way of thinking how to compose music than like sitting down with a guitar. And yeah. So as someone who plays other instruments, have you written music on other instruments? You said you've played other instruments, but well, how does it feel different to write music this way?
I don't write music.
Oh, okay. That's,
it took me a really long time to figure out that I am not a composer.
Hmm.
And I wasted decades learning this. I mean, you figure, with electronic instruments, you have so much control that, I can script everything. And, you know, especially with computers coming along, you can load up a nearly infinite number of sounds and have complete control over it. And it seemed like the ideal thing, but I don't know. I waste a lot of time with Reason, a number of other programs who I can't even remember, and decided, no, I'm a player, because I do the same thing on guitar. I do the same thing on piano. Sax, I'm a little bit more of a sheet music reader, but still, it's all improvisational. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know a few show pieces on each thing and, a little rock and roll on the guitar or whatever, but mostly improvisational. And so this became the same thing.
Yeah. No, that's, I think it's good as a musician to figure out what you're good at and what you enjoy, more importantly.
Especially what you're not good at.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So I think it'll help to provide some context to take a break, and I'm going to play one of your songs. Let's take a listen to Westbound.
Thank you.
So, Westbound.
Yeah.
That we just listened to.
Yes.
is a really good illustration of what I was talking about for generative music techniques. There's a programmed bass line in it that just kind of repeats, a rhythm figure that repeats through the whole song. The drums are synthesized. It's a sine wave oscillator and some noise that's just gated. So you get, you know, poon and tss out of it. And those are generated with clock dividers. So you take you're probably about a 16th note. It's been some years since I recorded that, but your basic 16th note beat, and then divide that by various things, and then change the divisors over time also, and then add those, you know, the sum of all of those things becomes the rhythm. So it's all mathematics. But the lead voice in it was actually played with a joystick.
Really?
And yes. And One Direction was the range of notes available, and the other direction, if I recall correctly, was probably the decay on the envelope to get a little bit longer and shorter notes. And then the choice of notes was determined by a device called a quantizer. So in a modular synthesizer, we have analog control voltages, and we can add them, we can subtract them, divide, whatever, but it's 1 volt per octave. So from C to C is 1 volt. If I take another 1 volt signal and I combine those two in a mixer, I have 2 volts. Now it's gone up 2 octaves, C to C to C. So if I expand, so what I had going on there was a slow sine wave. So if you think I think most people know what a sine wave looks like. So that was feeding into this joystick that was controlling how wide a range of that was going into this quantizer. And the quantizer takes this incoming arbitrary voltage and locks it into note values. And so it's a choice of scale. In this case, it was probably, you know, the equivalent of C, G, C, and then you can add more notes into it. So I was playing the whole melody with a joystick going left, right, up, down, and then a switch controlling my note choices. And if you listen to it, it sounds like somebody's playing a keyboard.
Yeah,
and, it does. And you know, I haven't listened to it in some time, but it comes up every now and then, you know, in the rotation. And it I've done a lot of music this way. That one came out just in a particular way that sounds more keyboardy than a lot of what I do. And it's a really good example. I like to, you know, people asking, what can you do with generative music? Because you think, you know, this Berlin School, very locked in Kraftwerk sound and... I think you can get a lot more out of it than that. And that's what I try for, is stuff that sounds human.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you make that joystick setup? Like, how did that come
together?
No,
that was a module from a whimsically. So some of the companies in the modular world, the name of this company, so-called, is probably a guy, you know, forgive me if you're out there, but I think a guy in his garage putting things together is called Flight of Harmony. Is the name of the company. It was a Choices joystick that I used to have. But yeah, it's something you could make. You could, you know, rate a joystick out of an RC controller or something and rig it up, and it would be pretty easy. And that's one of the really cool things about modulars is they're pretty low tech. You know, it's 60s, 70s technology mostly with some digital control and some now, you know, digital signal processing for getting some of the effects and stuff. But in principle, it was all stuff developed by Don Buchla and Bob Moog back in the early 60s. And some of the circuits that are in here, I have a module, this little guy right here, has what's called a low-pass gate in it, two of them. And primitive technology. It's basically it was originally a light bulb shining at a light-dependent resistor, and then they would wrap tape around it or something, and it's called a Vactrol. And it's a super primitive way of going. Now it's a little bit more modern because they use an LED, but they're still really crude, kind of inaccurate devices that have a particular response that they give to the sound. And that's all I've ever used is low-pass gates. And it's a very, it's kind of a signature sound. They call it Buchla bongos from this. If you hit it with a really short envelope, it kind of has this bongo-like decay to it.
Oh, neat.
But yeah, it's very crude, which means that you can make really simple devices that will talk to it. You know, I've made all kinds of weird, you know, little battery power things and, you know, slash up some things, and you can get interesting control elements out of it, including, you know, people do like Wii controllers and things and hack them up and give alternative control devices.
So how much of your setup is like stuff that you've made yourself, or how much modification do you do?
It depends. Right now, not very much. I have this delay pedal that I hacked over the weekend, and that is a pretty small part of this. There's one other module in here that I hacked because it was so badly made in the first place, it had to be. It sounds great, but it's just a horrible train wreck of electronics. And I have another one that I need to modify for more gain, the input, because I want to plug a mic into it, and it's not quite enough. But most of what's in here right now is pretty much the way it rolled out of the so-called factory.
Yeah, and what factory was that?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. I have probably 8-9 different manufacturers represented here in this very small modular.
There's that much. It all looks so cohesive, though.
Well, they're aluminum. You know, it's an aluminum faceplate. But I can tell you, so all of these are from the same guy, because this is a format he came up with. They're one rack unit tall, and they call them tile modules. So this guy is up in Vancouver, British Columbia, and they were made there. He also made these, and he actually is one of the few that has like a real company. So he has employees and everything, and it's like the real deal. But some of the others, I understand the guy who made this little thing is based in North County, San Diego, I heard recently. This is made in Latvia, actually ordered, shipped from Latvia. Yeah, it was pretty cool looking post thing on it. It's made by a company called Make Noise, who's celebrating their 10-year anniversary in about a week or two in North Carolina. It's a former employee of Moog, actually. These two guys are New York, I think. This was Los Angeles. And this is a guy who just made these expanders. So I have six. I have another one of those, the ones with the four knobs on it. Six of his modules, but it's literally like a dining table setup. And he's just a very gifted DIY. I think he writes software for a living, but he's gone deep into the electronics, and he had a need and he made them and then decided other people needed them too. But you can't say it's a quote company. So yeah, they're from all over the place. And then I may have bought them used from somebody in Singapore. You know, there's this worldwide network of people. I've done trades in, I haven't done any in Africa, but trades and sales pretty much everywhere else. Asia, Australia, Europe, shipping stuff to Russia is really sketchy.
Really? Wow. There's people all over the world playing around with this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the magic of the internet, is the community of people. You know, this happens in other things. There's, photography, astronomy, and other things that I'm into, where it's these communities of people that get to know each other. And this is no different, although I think the people that have been around for a long time are maybe a little bit more rabid, really deep, deep down the rabbit hole. And a lot of them are just, you know, they collect modules seemingly. It's like Pokemon cards.
Yeah.
And they have these enormous, enormous things, but it's, you know, it's still cheaper than a boat.
I guess so.
Because everything is. But yeah, and so the cross-pollination, which has enabled a lot of people with the skills and interest to get a crash course in what has gone before them technologically, and to also give them the means to produce them cheaply with contract manufacturing. So you can go download a couple of programs, do your design work, and then upload the result to a contract manufacturer in China and get back product in a week. For cheap, for really cheap. And
do you trust it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's excellent quality. Almost everything in here was probably made that way. Some of it was made domestically or in North America, but a good deal of it is contract manufacturing overseas. And the quality, I mean, our iPhones are like, you know, are made there. And Yeah. So it's enabled people with an idea, but not $100,000 in capital to go realize these artistic tools. And there's a website out there called Modular Grid that tracks the available modules for pretty much any modular format. And right now there's over 6,000 for Eurorack format, different modules listed. Now there's a lot of duplicates, a lot of DIY one-offs and things like that, but conservatively, I would say 3,000 commercially available different modules. Mm. And it's exploded. I mean, it's in the past probably 5 years, three quarters of those came out in the past 5 years probably.
Wow. So are you like always on the lookout for new and interesting stuff or?
No.
No?
No. It was pretty stable for years. I didn't change much of anything. And probably in the past couple of years, I changed some. It was the big change was this thing that I used, the typing keyboard, the programmable module, because I had kind of reached the limits of what I could do with a traditional style small rig like I was doing, and I felt like I was repeating myself a lot and wanted to go in a more compositional approach, like I was saying earlier. And so I took a chance because I thought I might hate this a lot. And it's been a little bit love-hate, but I'm growing to like it. So there's been more change recently, but no, for years I didn't change anything. But it's very typical. There's what's called GAS, gear acquisition syndrome. And you know, I
think guitar players have that too.
Yes. This pedal will be the one. These strings, this guitar. Yes. I'm kind of the same way with guitars too. I've had the first new guitar I got in probably 30 years was 2 years ago, I think. It was an Ibanez acoustic that has resulted in me playing guitar a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a great guitar. It's an instrument, and I think you have to stick with it like any other instrument to really learn it.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, it's practice, mm-hmm. practice and being forced to practice by, you know, being booked for something and then, you know, frantically 3 days before, what am I going to do? Which for an improvisational musician is pretty nerve-wracking sometimes, but...
But you're playing out. You play a lot of interesting stuff. You said you. What was the thing that you were doing? It was some kind of festival or something out of San Diego you were doing a few weekends ago.
Well, so it got really cold in the mountains, so we ended up at the beach. But very suddenly the forecast deteriorated. We were going to do an ambient event, which I don't feel there's enough. That's where my musical passion kind of is in what I would call small music. It's fun to go out and get really loud and stuff, but I think there aren't enough places and ways that you can experience smaller music in a public setting.
What do you mean by smaller music?
So I guess the, even things without beats at all, I guess would be one way to describe it. So just, you know, pure drone sound, that kind of thing, stuff to zone out to. Mm. And it's typically, you know, you may run across it as a background in some other setting, but not live. And some like-minded people, we decided I found a good camp spot. So we're going to haul in a small battery powered PA and some other stuff and do it up in the trees. And it got really, really cold.
Oh, yeah.
The forecasters were like for the mid to low 30s. Ooh. All of a sudden, you know, it dropped from 50 overnight to that. And 50 mile an hour winds.
Oh.
And yeah, I forget that. So we wound up doing this down at Mission Beach or Mission Bay rather, down by the boat ramp. And it was really cool actually, because I also have an FM transmitter. And so we had a radio station going.
Oh, nice.
And small portable speakers plugged into radios, you know, spaced out for some distance. And so the sound wasn't coming from anywhere in particular. So there will be more of this. Look for some pirate radio stuff here and there. It's
like
coming.
It. It's cool.
It's coming. Especially places you aren't supposed to. We'll save that for another time. But
sure. So how many artists were involved in that?
There were, I think, just four of us showed up for Mission B, you know, the Mission Bay thing. But I think the majority of us, there probably would have been 8 or 10 of us probably contributing.
Just getting together, making some ambient sounds. Like, were you playing together? Was it like individual sets or?
I did some live stuff. Steve, who performs his other with two R's. Hi, Steve. And Dasha, they actually, he's going to kill me because they came up with a name for the duo because they're going to play out together. And I can't remember what it is. So sorry, Steve and Dasha. But and my friend Zog, who is another, he is kind of a crossover guy. He sings, plays guitar in bands, and then also does electronic stuff. Jason Brockman, who has been, he's put on all kinds of parties and stuff. And I was thinking about this actually when I was on here, is one of the other really cool things about this kind of small community is the people you meet come from every imaginable background. And it, I sit here and name drop for the next 20 minutes and not run out of just awesome people I've run across from the academic community, from the noise music community, from the, you know, DJ and dance EDM community, who those are all separate. I want to be clear. Which has led to, you know, I played in Detroit a couple of years ago during Movement, doing techno in Detroit, which, you know, of all the places I never thought I would find myself, that was right at the top of the list. And got to meet some just amazing people to, you know, the monthly show that I used to run here called Fully Patched down at Kava Lounge. And the people that would, hey, you know, there's a place where we can go do this live analog controlled music. And I met some amazing people there. Open Oscillator has been just a tremendous asset. Jeff and Daniel and those guys do just an amazing job. And the UCSD community, they have a very strong presence in electronic music and a long heritage in it too, in experimental music, and that's still going strong. And so a lot of those people come out, and, you know, it's, I think if you can always find yourself being the least talented person in the room, then you're in the right place. And I find that I look around and I'm like, man, I'm lucky. You know?
Yeah, it's such a cool scene here with electronic music. I feel like the more I get into it, the more there is to find, the more people I find who are doing something really unique and creative. Yeah. It's a cool scene.
Last night, was that last night? God, yes, it was last night. It's been a really interesting day. last night, I met a guy who was Harry Partch's assistant back in the 1960s. And Harry Partch was one of the original proponents of microtonal music, famously made some really big complex instruments in the 30s and 40s, and then wound up at UCSD shortly after the university was founded, and is pretty famous in experimental music circles. And there's scales named after him. Famously, there's a 43-tone Harry Partch scale. And
43-tone.
Wow, so there's 12 in our normal scale that we're used to. So yeah, 43-tone scale. And his assistant, who is still here in San Diego, and has worked in and around this kind of music since the 60s. And, you know, they were building electroacoustic stuff. He was telling me, you know, some of the stories from the early to mid 70s in building these electronic instruments, the experimental stuff they did, the shows they put on and everything else. And, you know, you start to get a sense of the history behind it. You know, it's just a kind of a mind-blowing conversation, really, to think about how long this has been going on. But you don't hear about it. Nobody tells you about it. It doesn't show up in the charts, you know. And if you're lucky, you'll be in the right place at the right time and get to meet some of these people.
Right. Yeah. It's not getting posted all over social media.
No.
You just have to go out and find it. Yeah.
I asked this gentleman if he was on Facebook. He laughed at me. So, yeah, no.
That's actually kind of nice to hear.
Here's my card. Like, here's my card. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Cool. Let's take another break and listen to one of the other tracks. This one's called Dust and Shadow.
Thank you.
And we're back. That's a cool track. Tell me about it.
Well, that one is the opposite of what we played before. This was actually just traditional 8-step analog sequencer. So we have 8 steps. There's a lot of delay in it, so it's delaying it by probably 2 or 3 steps, I don't know. But that's what makes it sound like there are chords. But there's one note playing, and it's playing every single step, and I'm turning knobs. So I'm programming, I'm playing it. The difference, if you didn't know to listen for it, is that it's actually microtonal. It's using an Indian scale. I think it was called Sa Grama or something. I found on the archive for microtonal music, and I built a microtonal quantizer.
So what exactly does microtonal mean?
So microtonal, in Western music, we have it's pretty much been settled since the mid, about 1750 or so, that we're all going to use the 12-tone equal tempered scale. So there's an equal division between each of the 12 notes on, let's say, a piano keyboard. And in systems that have been used previously, if you played something, if you tuned, let's say, in C, then as long as you stayed in C, it was very in tune. And you have these harmonies that I'll get to in a second what the difference is. But the further that you got away from that key, the more out of tune it would get until it was completely unacceptable to play in, I don't know exactly, but probably like B flat or something. It would be so out of tune that you couldn't do it. And so you couldn't do things that we take for granted now, which is to transpose. You can play the same thing in a different key, and it will be higher or lower, but the harmonies and dissonances will remain the same, more or less. And so we all agreed on this, and that was common convention, and that's how we've been making music in the West ever since. Well, not everywhere. So if you go to the Middle East, you will encounter different musical traditions. So some of the Arabic scales with these quarter tones or smaller, these little lilts that are characteristically Eastern, you know, make you instantly think, oh, this is Eastern music. Although the blues depends on quarter tones too.
Hmm.
So there's in between. So it's a quarter tone. A full tone is 2 keys on a piano. So if you go from a white key to a black key, that's a half step. And it's a lot of the blues stuff, some of the Arabic music traditions will use a tone that is in between, so it's a quarter tone instead of a half tone, which is from one key to the next. And then you get into some of the really, so microtonal is one way of defining the note space is with it's a unit called cents, just like pennies, cents. And there are 1,200 cents in one octave. And so if you have 12 tones, there's 100 cents in between each note on an equal tempered scale. So if you are doing less than 100 cents per note, then it's commonly agreed you're doing some sort of microtonal something. And so you may have the same just 12 tones in a scale, but it may be that the distribution where the notes are is unequal. And the reason they'll do that is because it's not really in tune. The scale we're used to now, this equal tempered scale, is not exactly in tune. It's just enough out of tune, so it's sort of a compromise between, you know, being able to play relatively in tune and also being able to transpose versus being able to play extremely well in tune but not being able to transpose. Some instruments, and this is what I was referring to earlier, like singers, brass ensembles, sometimes you will hear them, a choir will hit this harmony, barbershop quartets also will do this, they'll hit this harmony that just sounds so pure, it you know, just sets your hair on end. And the reason why is because they're not doing this equal tempered thing. They're doing some variation on just intonation, which is the perfect intervals of harmony. And the reason they can do that is because unlike with a piano, they can change the pitch.
Wow. Yeah.
Just by ear. So next time you listen to a choir or usually brass ensembles will be the same way, not so much with woodwinds. You'll hear them hit these chords that for some reason sound really, really pure. And that's the reason why, is because they're using a slightly different tuning system and they're doing it by ear. So I built to get back to this track, I built a microtonal quantizer that will take these arbitrary analog voltages in and then lock them into pitch voltages on the way out, corresponding to notes in this Indian scale that is totally non-Western. And the thing to listen for, so now go back and rewind a little bit and listen to this. Listen for the dissonances where the notes don't agree. They don't fall into a harmony because it's different. It doesn't sound like what happens with Western music. But it was just an eight-step thing, and I'm sitting there turning knobs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So cool. So you had that plan for that going into it, at least for it to be microtonal?
Yeah, I was experimenting with scales. And that particular device I built had all kinds of weird stuff that I just like grabbed because it looked interesting. And so I had some African scales and some Korean scales and Indian stuff and, you know, whatever looked interesting. And some of it I didn't get any musical result out of, but I recorded at least a couple of tracks that made it onto albums from those. And if I didn't tell you, you probably wouldn't know that it was microtonal music.
No, yeah. No. You would assume that that would sound really dissonant or somehow
weird.
Off-putting.
Yeah. Weird, yes.
Yeah, but it actually sounds, that track sounds pretty melodic and enjoyable.
Conventional.
Almost,
yes.
Yeah.
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 But when you, so when I tell you that and you go back and listen, then you will hear it because it's off. But in a pleasing way, especially for me, it's the harmonies are really nice and because they're different, but it's in the dissonances, which I also found. So in this microtonal thing, they've theorized about what Johann Sebastian Bach used for tuning for his compositions. And there's some agreement that at some point he was using this particular tuning called Werkmeister 3. And so I retuned my piano to this, about the middle four octaves of it, and tried what
like
little...
actual
piano. Yeah, yeah. I have a about 100-year-old Chickering upright grand.
Yeah, isn't it a huge pain to tune a piano?
It's, well, to do it properly, you need more skill than I have, okay. But I get by.
Okay.
And
yeah.
So I tuned it. I have a tuner that can do some alternate tunings, and I tuned about four octaves of it to Werkmeister 3 and then played Bach again on it, and it was a revelation. I've heard it. I mean, there's YouTube demonstrations of this, but it's not the same as in person. And it's in the dissonance. You're like, oh, now I understand why he wrote this way.
Huh.
Because it sounds to a non-musician, I'm not sure it would be as big of an impact. My wife didn't hear as big a difference as I did. But to me, it was a revelation. And you know, so I think that it's these subtle things in music a lot of times that, you know, use your ear a little bit more and use, you know, the technical side of it to help you get there, but then listen to the result. And there's a lot of feeling in between the notes.
Mm. Wow. Music is so cool. There's so much to explore in every direction, you know? And yeah, that's why I really appreciate having you on here and hearing your perspective. Yeah. So do you have any shows coming up other than you're going to play Open Oscillator? Do you have anything else coming up?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Open Oscillator is always super fun, more for what other people do, and it's also just a fun playground. Going to be there every other month. Just go if you have any interest in this stuff at all. And yes, I'm playing Kava Lounge I don't have a calendar, but there's a show called Scratch that is oriented around live improvised electronic music. And there's some heavy hitters, Drona Drokar, which is Drona and Jesse Karras, put out a wall of sound. Austin Speed, who's a longtime regular around, and oh God, I forget who else is on the bill, but and little old me. as at Kava Lounge, I want to say it's the 13th of June.
Okay.
And then there's a show coming together that the flyer should be out tonight. Caja Fuerte on June 30th in Tijuana, and it looks like it may have been expanded into a two-night show now.
I keep hearing about cool stuff in Tijuana.
TJ has a better electronic scene, I think, than San Diego.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
More risk-taking. There's I did a talk at an electronic music school down there, actually, on generative methods of composition. Partly in Spanish, it was really difficult.
Yeah.
But, But yes, there's a lot of people in the scene down there, and I would say the audiences are also, in a way, much more prepared for, you know, bring the weird. Mm. And so there's Borderland Noise Fest, which Ida Jimenez runs, and a lot of cross-border collaboration. But I think, you know, I prefer to play down there a lot of the time. It's a different experience, and it's people really respond. I lived down there for a while in the late 80s. Oh, yeah. And yeah, the city has changed a lot. It didn't used to be its own thing. Tijuana was a place that everybody came from other places in Mexico to cross the border. Mm-hmm. But now Tijuana has its own scene. You had Nortec that came up there with Nortec Collective. And if you haven't heard it, have you heard of Nortec?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you take norteño, you know, umpapa music, mm-hmm. accordions, tubas, and all that, and you combine it with techno.
What?
Yes.
That sounds...
Yeah.
So, I can't even imagine what that sounds like.
So it's Bostic and Fusible are the two remaining. They're touring now as Bostic and Fusible from Nortec Collective. So they sort of disbanded. There were, I think, four members through the 2000s. And up to about 3 years ago or so. But they have a number of releases, and it's really excellent. I've been a fan for a long time and keep missing them in person. I mean, because one of them, Ramon, he lives in Tijuana, actually, and is a dentist who also does electronic music, and they tour the world.
Wow.
So they have a really great scene down there, and there's a whole lot of cross-border collaboration. A lot of us know each other.
Cool. So what's that show that you said you're...
So that one, what was the name of the show? Well, it's a Caja Fuerte, June 30th, and now they may be doing the 29th or July 1st also. I don't know. It's in flux. There's like a Facebook chat going right now saying we got too many great people. And so look for that one, Caja Fuerte, at the end of June, and should be a really good show.
Cool. And so you, do you have a Facebook page? Do you have, you up in the socials?
According to Google, I am a musical artist. It's official. So if you just look for Pretty How Town,
all one word,
make it lowercase because I'm pretentious like that. And actually, so I think some people know, but where my artist name came from is from the poet E.E. Cummings, who was a famous experimental poet from about the 1920s through the 1960s is when he was active. And he and Charles Bukowski are probably my two favorite poets. And E.E. Cummings wrote a quite famous poem called Anyone Lived in a Pretty How Town. And that is the first line of the poem. And it had a big impact on me. I ran across it as one of the few things that came out of English class in high school that really stuck with me. And it was a music project of me and a friend of mine in the late 80s, and then it was dormant for a long time. And when I was looking around for a name, I just slapped that on, for lack of anything better, and it stuck. And now I don't know because people can't figure out what in the world does that mean. And it does mean something. And I would encourage everybody to go read the poem and then try and figure out what it means. But So yes, there is something behind it, but
once you explain that to me, I remember it now. Yeah, once you learn where it's from, it's pretty cool.
You know, I've kicked E. Cummings out of the search results. I think nice. The first nine. Yeah,
take that. Awesome, and you have a great SoundCloud. A lot of really cool tracks on there.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, is it just / Pretty How Town? SoundCloud.
It.
Were you able to get that?
I'm pretty sure I had to go. Yes, I think it was a Pretty How Town somewhere. I picked up Pretty How .town recently. I haven't acted. There's nothing there yet. Sure. I need to redirect it to the site, but where I have absolutely nothing.
but at some point.
but at some point I might. I have someone helping me because I really hate promoting myself, and I'm not sure why I would promote myself, actually, because I do this because I have to.
Yeah.
You know, I managed to get signed to an indie label that was my favorite net label.
Oh, yeah?
And going back to 2003, and they...
What label is that?
Called Magnitude. And John Buckman is a hero of mine, and I was in online media distribution back when he founded this. So it's, I was a director of R&D for an internet startup that did downloading jukeboxes. And when he started this in 2003, I remember the day he did it is when the idea of a net label was brand new. And then three, four years ago, I never really submit my music anywhere, and sent it in, and he's like, yes, we'll take all three albums. And I was absolutely shocked. I mean, and so that's resulted, you know, I find somebody told me, hey, you're on Spotify. That was a few months ago. Really? Wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And you're out there and playing cool shows and everything, and you're not just, you don't have like a social media marketing plan that you're...
No.
You're just out there doing your thing. I think that's because you love it. That's what matters.
Yeah, I'm very, very, very fortunate to know some really, really nice, talented people. And I think the DIY ethic behind all of this underground stuff, and almost all of it is very, very underground, is amazing. The amount of work and love and money and everything else that goes into it is astounding. And to be able to, chip in somewhat, and, it's ridiculous what some people do, the amount of work they'll go to, and there's no prospect of making a dime.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, it's everybody coming together and doing their part.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of it is as rewarding as the rest of it.
Pretty cool. Well, thanks for coming to the studio. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
Time for chatting with me. It's been fun. Thanks again for listening to episode number 13 of the Sunshine Sound podcast. We have older episodes up on sunshinesoundcenter.org. Also, be sure to check us out on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. We recently got a volunteer to help out with our social media, so we'll definitely be stepping up our game there, and really hope to be doing more to promote the local music scene and to promote all the stuff that the artists on this show are doing. But if you have any questions for me, want to get in contact, want to suggest any guests, you can shoot me an email at christine@sunshinesoundcenter.org. That's all I have for you today, but I'll talk to you again soon. Have a good one.